Across Australia, you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Good morning, this is AM, I'm Peter Cave. The death of North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il, apparently from a heart attack, has put the North Asia region on high alert as governments and their analysts try to work out what it will mean for the future of the nuclear-armed and impoverished hermit kingdom. A young son, Kim Jong-un, has been given the title the Great Successor, but little is known about the 20-something general, who's the dear leader's third son. Our correspondent is in the South Korean capital. Well, Stephen McDonald, you're in Seoul. Is there dancing in the streets?
Well, on the one hand, you'd think there would be, because for so many decades, the leader of North Korea, which, you know, these two countries are still officially at war, has been giving them so much grief, and yet, really, there's a sense of trepidation. I think people just don't know what's going to happen now that Kim Jong-il has died and his son, one of his sons, Kim Jong-un, has taken over.
Has there been any sign of military action from the North Koreans?
Well, there was one report of a short-range missile being tested off the east coast of North Korea. Now, this is only one media report and it hasn't been confirmed by the South Korean military yet, but it's this type of thing that's making people nervous, and it's exactly why the South Korean military is on high alert, because North Korea can be unpredictable at the best of times, and with a leadership transition, one that's, you know, it's not quite clear how this is all going to pan out, well, they're really not sure what's going to happen.
Indeed, it's not clear at all. A 20-year-old son, no one knows much about him. How much is coming out?
Yes, well, he was educated in Switzerland, apparently. We're not sure what his age is. It's 20-something, could be 27, 28. And this is someone in charge of 1.2 million soldiers and nuclear weapons. Now, he's had little experience, and a few years ago, even his own people didn't know what he looked like. He suddenly appeared on the scene, and we have North Korean television today urging people to get behind this man. So really, it's ripe for uncertainty. And, you know, in some ways, the South Koreans, at least they knew what they got with Kim Jong-il. Now with Kim Jong-un, they really don't know what's going to happen next.
He is being groomed by an uncle and an aunt, according to some reports.
Yes, well, that's right. His uncle and aunt apparently have been told to sort of usher him through this leadership process, because the danger is that the generals might turn around and say, well, look, really, you're not up to the task and we're taking over. Now, if that transition didn't really go so smoothly and the generals did decide to seize power, or there were two blocks, one backing him and one backing the generals, well, we'd be heading into really dangerous, uncharted waters then.
When the elder Kim became ill, there were reports that the general had indeed taken over already.
Well, that's right. I mean, for years he's been looking shocking, and he just sort of disappeared for a couple of years and then suddenly reappeared. I suppose that the thinking was that he'd had some top-notch surgery in China or something like that, and that he was back up to the task. But then more recently he was looking pretty crook again, and now all of a sudden he's died on a train, apparently of a heart attack.
Stephen McDonald in Seoul. The US Secretary of State has called for a peaceful and stable transition of power in North Korea as Washington scrambles to respond to the death of Kim Jong-il. US officials acknowledge they don't know much about his anointed successor, Kim Jong-un, and the Obama administration is reaching out to Russia and China for help. From Washington, Craig McMurtry reports.
US officials had little or no advance warning of the death of Kim Jong-il. Speaking to a CNN reporter while travelling in Germany, the US chairman of the Joint Chiefs was asked if he's worried.
Well, look, I worry about transitions every place. I'm worried about a transition in North Korea. I'm worried about a potential transition in Syria. I'm worried about the continuing transitions in Egypt, yes.
General Martin Dempsey says age is a factor in the succession of the North Korean dictator's little-known son, Kim Jong-un.
We've done a significant amount of work to try to understand him. I would only say at this point that he is young. to be placed in this position.
Barack Obama phoned South Korea's President Lee overnight. Publicly, the administration is taking a cautious wait-and-see approach. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke to reporters after meeting her Japanese counterpart in Washington.
We both share a common interest in a peaceful and stable transition in North Korea.
The Republican 2012 contenders aren't being nearly so restrained. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and diplomat John Huntsman labelling Kim Jong-il a ruthless and conscienceless tyrant, while Michelle Buckman claims the son could be worse.
His successor could quite likely be even worse than Kim Jong-il. And that's why worse, with the, together working with the Chinese, the North Koreans are actively working to help the Iranians to obtain missile technology to deliver a nuclear weapon. This cannot be.
Washington is worried about a potential power struggle and the security of the North's nuclear arsenal. Former UN ambassador in the Bush administration, John Bolton.
The real threat is the North Korean nuclear weapons, at worst case, being used in the civil strife that may follow, or to see competing North Korean generals auctioning off those nuclear weapons and other parts of the nuclear program to the highest bidders, and that's far from implausible.
Former State Department spokesman, journalist and academic James Rubin also sees opportunity.
I think it is important to explore whether the new regime under a new leader is willing to go forward and do something that his father never would do, which is to put their nuclear weapons program back into the bottle, to dismantle it, to freeze it.
According to officials, the Obama administration had been poised to announce the resumption of food aid to North Korea in exchange for Pyongyang returning to nuclear disarmament talks. Because of Kim Jong-il's death, that announcement is expected to be delayed. This is Craig McMurtry for AM.
In Indonesia, 15 more survivors have been found on an island 200 kilometres from where their overloaded wooden boat capsized and sank off East Java in a tragic attempt to find asylum in Australia. At least 200 people were thought to be on board, and so far just 49 survivors have been found, according to the ABC's George Roberts, who's been talking to some of them in the town of Blitar, where they've been questioned by Indonesian authorities. He says they've told him harrowing stories of the disaster and of how they were brought to Indonesia by people smugglers.
They do really seem very desperate. They've been begging. I've had at least a couple of them begging me, are you going to help us? Can you help us? The Indonesian authorities aren't helping us, and you must help us. They really have not made it a secret that they are really trying to do everything they can to try to get to Australia. Yesterday they were threatening to get on another boat if the Australian government doesn't help. But the other thing is that they're starting to sort of realise that perhaps if they seem to be helping out, that perhaps that might be another way to effectively smooth the path for them to come to Australia. And some of the stories coming out have not quite stacked up. One of the chaps that we spoke to changed his story slightly from the morning to the evening after speaking to immigration authorities here. He then started telling us that one of the kingpins, a guy called Syed Abbas, who's wanted in Australia for people smuggling, alleged people smuggling charges, who's in prison here, who's allegedly running his network from the prison. This young man said that that Syed Abbas called him and he wanted to meet with Syed Abbas and said, can I meet you? This is what the young man said about that.
He told that no, he is already in jail here in Jakarta. He cannot see me, but he told that if you want to go to Australia, just give me $5,000 and then I will get you as soon as possible. Actually, I didn't know yet. I was anxious that how come it is possible. I pay that. I told, is it legal? He told, no, I will get you by boat. There's no danger. Everything is good. Many people going like this on the same way to Christmas Island, and then the cases are being processed by Australian authorized in Christmas Island.
Why do you have doubts about what he's saying?
Look, it just didn't seem to stack up with the story from earlier on. It also doesn't seem to work in terms of whether the so-called kingpin or mastermind of this network, while he might be running it from prison, why he would get personally involved with one asylum seeker out of 250 potentially who are paying $5,000 each year. He would be trying to distance himself from the operation and keep it at arm's length and let the minions below him do the work. But it was mainly that the story didn't seem to stack up, and it kind of came after being interrogated by the People Smuggling Task Force here. Suddenly this name came up. Now, we also know that they've got a couple of computers. I've seen them with laptops. I don't know who's brought those in for them. They've also got fresh phones. They're getting phone calls from family, and they are reading the reports in the newspapers. And there was a report that linked Syed Abbas to this situation, and that's another possible way.
And what do they say about what happened when the boat went down? How did it happen?
Look, they've told us some harrowing stories. They're saying that it really started listing to one size, it capsized over, and then more water came on board. There were people below deck who managed to scramble out windows. One guy said that the force of the water coming through them actually pushed him out. But then they say that there were bodies in the water. They saw family members. They were trying to save them, trying to help them. They grabbed onto the upturned boat, and one of the men from Iran told them there were still people inside the upturned while so the survivors on the outside were trying to get on top of that to save themselves, effectively pushing the boat down into the water with other people inside, and then how another wave hit them, and then they all got separated.
The ABC's George Roberts reporting there from Blitar in East Java. You're listening to AM Around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's 21 minutes past 7. Papua New Guinea's leadership crisis appears to be all but over after the Governor-General switched allegiances and recognised Peter O'Neill as Prime Minister. Mr. O'Neill now has the support of the head of state, the public service and most of the population. His rival, Sir Michael Somare, maintains he's still the legitimate leader, but there seems to be little he can do except go back to court, PNG correspondent Liam Fox reports.
It was Melanesian politics at its finest. Two men who only a few days ago had been on opposite sides of this political conflict now sipped champagne at Government House.
To Her Majesty the Queen of Papua New Guinea.
To the Queen of Papua New Guinea.
Thank you.
The Governor-General, Sir Michael Ogio, now says Peter O'Neill is PNG's Prime Minister. Last week he'd sworn in Sir Michael Somare's cabinet after the Supreme Court found his removal from office was unlawful and ordered his reinstatement. But in a statement, the Governor-General says he was wrong. He received flawed advice and now realises only Parliament can appoint a Prime Minister. Mr. O'Neill praised his change of heart.
I thank the Governor-General for the humility that he has shown and the courage that he has shown. He has been under duress. He had made decisions now. He has regretted and he has reversed those decisions for the best interest of the country.
The Governor-General's support came after PNG's top bureaucrat announced he'd be taking orders from the O'Neill government. The Chief Secretary, Manasupe Zurinok, said in PNG politics, the majority rules, and Mr. O'Neill has the numbers on the floor of Parliament. So, all up, Mr. O'Neill has the support of the Head of State, most MPs, the public service, the police, the military, and most Papua New Guineans. But Sir Michael is refusing to back down.
I've sworn in as a Prime Minister. There is only one cabinet and one Prime Minister. We have laws here in our country which quite clearly governs our being in the country.
In an interview with Radio Australia, Sir Michael says he'll go back to court, but the courts are closing down for Christmas and don't reopen until February. At times, the 75-year-old sounded out of breath and confused, and he accused Australian journalists of misrepresenting the political situation.
For God's sake, know what you people are doing and stop meddling. So much of your reports have meddled the minds of everybody in Australia. We know we're quite comfortable.
Mr. O'Neill says it's time Sir Michael thought about life after politics.
Sir Michael is a respected leader in the country. He's a father of our country. We want him to retire with dignity and the honour that he deserves. And we wish him well when he recuperates from his health issues when we move forward.
He also praised Papua New Guineans for their response to the political upheaval. Despite fears the standoff would spark violence, the country has stayed remarkably calm. This is Liam Fox in Port Moresby for AM.
Back in Australia, one of the nation's biggest ever resources projects has had a major setback. The gas giant Woodside says the delay to its $30 billion Kimberley gas project has nothing to do with the protests that have dogged the development, but environmentalists are claiming a minor victory. They say the project should be shelved for good. Adam Harvey reports.
It all looked so promising for the enormous Browse Basin project. Just 6 months ago, in an emotional ceremony in Western Australia's Parliament House, Indigenous landowners sat down in front of the cameras to finally sign off on a deal that would see them receive over $1.5 billion in benefits. Under the plan, natural gas would be extracted off WA's northwest, piped to a processing plant near Broome, and then shipped to surging Asian markets. But now, the project has been hit with some big setbacks. First, Indigenous owners split over their approval. Then, the Supreme Court ruled that some vital paperwork was invalid. And now, Woodside says it won't meet its original deadline. It needs more time to organise the project. The state's Premier sounds confident.
The demand for gas is high. This is not a declining market. This is an increasing market for natural gas internationally. The market's there, the funding's there. It just needs some rejigging.
But the federal government wants it done as soon as possible. Woodside say it's a complex project and it just needs more time. But environmentalists say it's not that simple. Heidi Knorr from the Wilderness Society.
Yeah, Woodside are absolutely getting cold feet on this, and their investors will be getting cold feet as well. It's nearly 2012 and Woodside still doesn't have any environmental approvals for this project. It still doesn't have secure tenure on this project. And now it's said it won't be able to make a final investment decision on this either.
A small but determined group of protesters are continuing to frustrate attempts to clear land in the Kimberley.
This is just the wrong place to put Australia's biggest ever LNG development.
Resources industry watcher Peter Strachan, the editor of Stock Analysis, says the delay's got less to do with the protests and more to do with worker shortages.
These projects are not all over the place, and the number of people who've got actually expertise in building them and costing them and knowing, you know, the tricks of the trade, as it were, is quite few.
As it stands, the federal government has given Woodside a deadline of mid-year. Under the so-called use-it-or-lose-it clause, the lucrative Browse gas fields could then be open to competitors. Energy Minister Martin Ferguson says the government wants to see the gas extracted, and it's now up to Woodside to formally apply for more time.
Adam Harvey with that report. The surfwear retailer Billabong is close to a wipeout. The market yesterday punished the stock, with shares in the company falling more than 40%. David Taylor reports.
The cool, wet weather may be disguising summer this year, but it's also causing big headaches for companies relying on those sizzling hot summer days. Beach fashion retailer Billabong sells clothing and swimwear for surfers and beachgoers. The company's being caught in a rip this summer, and it's heading out to sea fast. Yesterday, the company was struggling for air as the market dumped the stock, investors fed up with management's ongoing excuses. Martin Lakos from Macquarie Private Wealth.
Yeah, look, a very big thumping, you know, down to over 40%, and certainly, I mean, that's a very big move. You know, that's typically what we do see when there's an earnings guidance surprise.
The surprise, though, wasn't related to the retail environment. Investors are all too aware that retailers right across the country are doing it tough as consumers tighten their purse strings. The blame for this recent fall has been put onto management. 5 months ago, the company announced its full-year earnings were down 18%. Shares were slammed 25%. The board wasn't even able to give any guidance for 2012. Yesterday, the retailer announced it expected sales for the 6 months to the end of the calendar year to be down 3%.
Well, earnings changes of that size don't reflect well on anyone inside the organisation. It reflects that some fundamental misunderstanding has taken place.
Core Data's Andrew Inwood. Investors seem to be losing faith in management and are exiting the stock in droves. To give you some idea, back in 2007, the stock was trading at over $17. It's now trading at just over $2. Analyst Roger Montgomery argues the Billabong brand itself is in need of a makeover.
The youth, I guess, who buy the products that Billabong sells, they tend to like things that are unconventional. So once this type of product becomes mainstream, becomes very big, the turning away that occurs can happen very quickly.
Whether the problem's competing with online stores or the higher Australian dollar or management that can't keep up, Australian retailers have some soul-searching to do.
It's not over yet, and I suspect that any any rush towards Christmas in spending, which of itself has been disappointing, will only get quieter once the new year comes back and people settle down to pay off their credit cards. Usually it's even quieter than it was before.
Analyst Roger Montgomery ending that report by David Taylor. To the finance now in New York, the Dow Jones is trading down 110 points at 11,756. The Nasdaq is trading down 32 points. In London, the FTSE has closed down 22 points. The Australian dollar below parity, 98.94 US cents. That's down 0.58 on yesterday's close. I'm Peter Cave, and that's AM for today.